I gave an in-home Bible study here some weeks ago, and when we give the in-home Bible study, whoever hosts the study has the opportunity to offer a suggestion for a topic that we might cover. So this particular individual said that they would like to have me bring a Bible study on some kind of obscure Old Testament story. You know, there's all kinds of stories in the Old Testament. It's a large section of books. Sometimes you read over these stories, and they said, well, just bring a Bible study about one of these obscure stories. I really enjoy when you get into that and study something maybe you don't look at or notice or think much about. So sure enough, I did, and I found one in Judges chapter 17. So that's what we're going to be covering here for the sermon, the second split. And I hope you will get a lot out of it and enjoy it. Here in Numbers, or excuse me, did I say Numbers? I meant Judges. Judges chapter 17. Now, we're familiar with the book of Judges that follows Joshua. Now, of course, Israel coming out of Egypt, you had the very prominent and the very visible Moses who led the people out of Egypt. Everybody knew who was speaking for God, who was directing everything, where they went for answers. When Moses was not permitted to go into the promised land, he turned everything over to Joshua. Joshua was the visible leader. He had the mantle of Moses. He parted the Jordan River when they crossed over to the promised land. Very clear as to who's guiding, who's directing. When Joshua died, that was it. There wasn't anybody. No, it wasn't turned over to Joshua's son or any other individual, and everybody was kind of left with, now what do we do? Actually, not that different in some respects from all of us at one time in the worldwide church. Mr. Armstrong, obviously the clear leader and the one that had raised up the church and all of that, and he turned it over to another individual, Mr. DeCotch, and so that was all very visible. But when we left that, well then, there wasn't anybody. And indeed, that was true. None of us felt like there was any one individual that clearly stepped forward that God had ordained and set up, and he was clearly the one. A few had claimed that for themselves, but those that developed the United Church of God never felt like any of them, to us, had fulfilled that. And so it was quite a transition from a very clear one individual making the decisions to now cooperating and working as a group of people. And it was somewhat similar at that particular time when Joshua died, and now we had this period of time when everybody was just there, is what it amounted to. Now, it's important to note that chapter 17 and chapter 18 are not in chronological order. In other words, you don't start with the book of Judges at a particular year, and as you go through each chapter, you come all the way so many hundreds of years later, because chapter 17 and 18 and chapter 19 through 21 are not in chronological order. Now, let me read. Nelson's Study Bible says the book of Judges closes with two appendices. The first is chapters 17 and 18. In other words, chapter 17 and 18 come very early on in the book of Judges. It's like something added at the end, which is, well, let me give you some more details of something that happened very early on. So it's kind of important to note that. It's not near the end of the book. It's really at the first part. So here we have in chapter 17 where it says there was a man of Mount Ephraim, his name was Micah, and he said to his mother, he said, well, Mom, you know that 1,100 shekels that somebody took and you had pronounced a curse on them? You know that 1,100 shekels? Well, Mom, I took it. I'm the one that took all of that. And so he spoke, and also in my ears he said, behold, the silver's with me. Well, she responded by saying, well, that disappoints me, but at least you're honest enough to tell me. So thank you for that. Thank you for telling me. So when he, Micah, restored the money and gave it back to his mother, the 1,100 shekels in verse 3 of silver to his mother said, well, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto God. I wanted to do something for God with that money. Wow, wonderful. She says, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I'll restore it back to you. He says, well, I had in mind, I wanted to do this for God. Well, I had in mind to make some kind of a graven image, which was certainly improper and wrong to do. But she had this idea. Now, here's, again, something we'll begin to see. Here's a mixture of religion, and it was an outright departure from all things that were godly, but it was sort of worshiping as it pleased her. Because right now, everybody was going down at this time to Shiloh. And that's where the tabernacle was. And God said, come to Shiloh, you worship at the tabernacle. That's what he set up. And she wants to set up something local. She gets this great idea. Well, I have in mind to make this little kind of shrine, and we'll have our own images, and we'll do it for God. And that's one of the important lessons we're going to see and take note of. Verse 4. Well, she gives Micah the money, and he said, well, no, I think this is your project. You better go ahead and do it. And so his mother took 200 shekels, and she gave them to the founder, and he makes a graven image and a molten image. Well, you're not allowed to do that. That isn't what God said to do. And she put them in Micah's house. So the man Micah had a house of gods and made an ephod. Now, that's a garment that the priest would wear. And also a teraphim, and those were sometimes used as an idol that people would consult to get an answer from. All of this was wrong for them to do. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So here's Micah. They spend a considerable amount of money, and they've modified the religion God gave them, and they make this little church or this shrine in their own home. And basically they're saying, why should we go all the way down to Shiloh? We can make one right here. Why don't we just do it here in the house? And even people in the town, you'd read later in chapter 18, the people in the towns went along with the idea. Well, this is great. Why travel down there? You see how they're beginning to come up with some of their own thinking, and it's all for God. After all, we're doing this for God and to him. And so that's what they do. They have this little shrine where they can worship. Verse 6, and here's the problem. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. There was no visible leader. It's before God raised up some of the judges. So everybody said, well, this seems fine to me. This is what I think we ought to do. And so that's what was taking place. Setting up this shrine so we didn't have to go all the way to Shiloh. Now, continuing, Verse 7, there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, the family of Judah, and he was a Levite, and he was traveling through there. And the man departed out of the city of Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place to live, make a living for himself. So he comes to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah. He stumbles upon Micah's house. And Micah said unto him, well, where are you from, stranger? What are you doing in town? And he said unto him, well, I'm a Levite, and I'm coming out of Bethlehem, Judah, and traveling, trying to find a place to settle down. And Micah said unto him, well, why don't you stay here? As a matter of fact, you can be unto me a father, a kind of a counselor, and a spiritual guide, and you can function as a priest. And I'll give you 10 shekels of silver every year, and I'll give you clothes to wear and your food, and you can stay here. And the Levite said, great, what a great gig this is. I'll take it. It's a deal. Now, that was not right for him to do. None of this is proper. None of this is according to the law. But they're going along, and everything in their mind is just hunky-dory, as they say. So, verse 11, the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man was unto him as one of his sons. And Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. So then said Micah, now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. Well, now I know we're going to be blessed. We got our own priest here We not only have these images in our shrine and our little religious place of retreat, we've got our own Levite and our own priest. Now I know that God's going to be pleased. He was convinced. And that's a very important and critical point, because we want to ask the question, well, why would we have this crazy story in the Bible? Of what value is this? These people set up a shrine and go through this, and the Levite comes along. Who needs this story? What is anybody going to get out of that? And why would it be important? Well, I've got 3 points why it's probably important for us. Point number one is that this was the first departure from God's religion after Joshua. This is the first departure where the people start going in their own direction. Now, mind you, it was still all for God as they thought of it. But they're veering off from God's religion. It was not a wholesale departure. It was a blending of God's way with idolatry. It was the sin of syncretism, where you're mixing and synchronizing the ways of God, the ways of the Old Testament, but with false ways. That's why we don't keep Christmas. Certainly there's a lot of things that, you know, about Christmas that families and music and people getting together and all of that, some of that's fine, even some of the giving as far as people trying to give to the poor or something like that, and nobody could be against that specifically. But it's the blending together with that which is wrong is why we don't participate in it. We don't have 1 foot in it and 1 foot out. Let's read Deuteronomy 12. We're familiar with this in verse 29. Deuteronomy 12, 29. When the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you where you go to possess them, and you succeed them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you don't be snared by following him after that they have destroyed from before you, and that you inquire not after their God, saying, well, how did these nations serve their God? Even so will I do likewise. You shall not do so unto the Lord your God. You're not going to borrow other people's religion and false ideas and blend it in and think that I'll be fine. But these people never saw that. Micah didn't see it. His mother didn't see it. The Levite should have known better. Chapter 18, you can read that as well. The Danites, they don't see it. It's the first departure from God's way in Israel since Joshua, who kept people on the straight and narrow, not individually and everybody making individual sins, but collectively. Well, it's important to know that everything religious is not spiritual. Everything religious is not spiritual. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 5. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 5, here is the Apostle Paul, the most spiritual man, probably beside Jesus Christ, in the New Testament. So Paul has had to defend himself on numerous occasions. 2 Corinthians 11, 5, he says, now I suppose I was not a bit behind the very chiefest false apostles. Well, I suppose in some of your minds and view, that I was probably right up there or fell just short of some of these other individuals that were setting themselves up as so righteous, so impressive, because some of these individuals came along, they were false apostles, but they were great preachers and dynamic, and they had so much love, and they were so spiritual that even members of the church kind of looked down on Paul. I suppose I was not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles, but though I be rude in speech, you see, his speaking ability and all of that, it didn't measure up to some of these orators that had some of the members swept off their feet. But we have been thoroughly made manifest among you in all things. So even Paul was looked down upon at times, though his spirituality exceeded everybody. One more in Acts chapter 17, verse 22. The point being, everything religious is not spiritual. Micah, his mother, the Levite, very religious. And it was all done for God. But it wasn't real spirituality. Acts 17, 22, Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill, and he said, "You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you're just too religious. You're into religion." It was really superstition. "You're just too religious. Caught up in religion." That's not doing him any good. All religion is not spirituality, or everything religious is not spiritual. It has to be of God, of course. The second point, why would we have this story in the Bible? Well, another reason would be to show how the human mind can drift from proper reasoning, to show the proclivity of the human mind to drift into its own thinking. Proverbs 16:2. Proverbs 16:2. "All the ways of man are clean in his own eyes." All the ways of man are clean in his own eyes. But the Lord weighs the spirit. Naturally, what we think is going to seem right in our own eyes. And so it was with these individuals. Well, this is wonderful. Well, God's bound to bless us now. We've even got our own priest. This is great. It was in their eyes, not God's. That wasn't the right thing to do. Deuteronomy 31:26. We, of course, always have to recognize this proclivity as human beings. We have to continually check ourselves, our attitude, our thinking. Is it God's thinking or is it what I want to think? Is it the conclusion I've come to? Deuteronomy 31:26 says, "Take this book of the law, put it in the side of the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness against you." I'm going to put it right in here, and later down the road, you're going to be able to look back and say, that's exactly what was written. We went astray exactly like it said we would. Or we're contrary to exactly what's written here. Because God knew they would do that. People have that proclivity. It's a human trait to slide off or veer off or drift off, and we're thinking all along how wonderful all of this is. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. I had have a niece, and it wasn't too long ago that she was talking to me. She had become engaged to a gentleman, and she's somewhat of a religious girl. And at least brings that up when I'm around. And she was mentioning, I didn't know all the circumstances, but when I was back home last time, she says, "Well, yes, and we were married, you know, at a certain date, and before that, well, I was pregnant with so-and-so." She said, "Well, I guess God just wanted us to have this child before we got married." Oh, is that really? Well, that's what she firmly believed. I guess God just wanted us to have it before we ended up even getting married. Well, that she was fully convinced of that. Well, I didn't say too much, but I didn't think that's what God really wanted, but she did. That's just natural. It's the way we are. How else would we know if something didn't guide us? Have any Christians ever invested in their own religion, their own ministry, their own whatever, to suit their own needs? Develop a designer religion to satisfy hurts or fears or needs or ideas, and this will suit me just fine? Anybody ever done that? Yeah, I think so. I mean, people out of the greater Church of God have done that. Know that they have. Some have done that, and individuals, I don't need to mention who they are, now they're indicted for tax evasion, one of the leaders, one of the groups, may go to jail. There's, you know, what comes after that. I've not heard this. When something like that happens, well, then a lot of times they'll say, well, you know, people can be very disappointed in that, being indicted for tax evasion and different things. They say, well, brethren, this is Satan's attack to try to thwart the work I'm doing. He's pulling out all stops, so send in more money for my defense so Satan doesn't win. Well, he can go on and on and on. Then somebody's going to say, well, be convinced that that's what it is. Without God's help, how would you know any different? You wouldn't always know. I was pastoring in New Orleans, and before I was in New Orleans, there had been another pastor there who had always been a little, kind of felt that he'd always had some kind of prophetic vision or spirit of prophecy, and he went off to Oregon, and quite a few people, or at least a handful of people from New Orleans, surrounding areas, went off to Oregon because they were going to be taken off to heaven. They had secret information and insight into the book of Revelation, and Christ was going to be returning by this date, and of course he didn't. And then that was only a test to see if you would remain faithful. He was going to be coming this time next year, and that came and went, and then there was still another test, and everybody's half held in fear that, well, what if it is really is the test, and I gave in and quit, and then finally I think he passed away, and that was the end of that. They were convinced and off following that individual with some really crazy ideas. So it helps to know that the human proclivity that we have, which is what these individuals had as well. Point number three. I think one important lesson from this story is to learn the lesson about the second commandment. Let's go to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, lesson of the second commandment. We don't look at the second commandment all that often. I mean, how does that really impact any of us? Where it says, you shall not make unto you any graven image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or that's in the earth beneath, that's in the water under the earth, that you shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them. For if the Lord your God, I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and to the children, the third and fourth generation, showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandment. Well, who has to worry about the second commandment? I mean, how many images do you have? When's the last time you heard about, well, somebody got suspended for church? Oh, really? What happened? Well, they found images. They found idols in his closet. Well, who ever heard of that? Never find anybody with that. Nobody ever has a problem with idols or images, do they? We really need to even worry about the second commandment? Well, I grew up in a church that had all kinds of them, Catholic church. We had them all around, and sometimes somebody says, well, doesn't the Bible say that you shouldn't have images? And we'd say, well, we're not worshiping these things. We don't worship them. They're just to remind us of Mary or Jesus or Saint Joseph or some of these other people. We're not worshiping them. That was our answer. And of course, that was somewhat true, but then in another sense, those statues, the picture of Jesus we had on the wall, those things were venerated. They had a certain kind of aura or holiness about them. Sometimes, you know, there's the tradition of kissing some of them. Isn't that true of St. Peter's and statue of St. Peter in Rome? The toe's gone. It's been kissed so much, the toe's gone. Well, that's a worship of those things. They're venerated and they're holy. And how you handle them and deal with them. And of course, they don't really even have that commandment. This commandment's not in the Catholic Bible. Some didn't know that, but this second commandment isn't there. What they do is they take this commandment out and they make two out of the tenth. So you're back to ten. You have 10 commandments in the Catholic Church. You just don't have the second. And the tenth is divided into two. You're back to 10. So that was never a problem to us in the Catholic Church, any of this. We had the answer and didn't think a thing of it. Well, let's go to 1 John chapter 5, verse 21. Because this was a big problem at the time of the New Testament church. There were a lot of idols in the religions of the day, many statues and idols. Why, there was even the statue of Diana, wasn't it? Diana of the Ephesians, and some of them thought it fell down from heaven. Well, 1 John chapter 5, verse 21, and this will be in the English Standard Version, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Keep yourselves from idols. So they had to be warned about that in the New Testament church. A lot of them came out of that from their former religions. Very common, much like what would be in some cultures and some churches today. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. 1 Corinthians 10, 7 tells the Paul writing to Corinth, do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What did they do when they wanted to go back to Egypt? Well, they had to make an idol first. They had to make a calf. Why didn't they just go back without? Because that was a part of their thinking. The culture, an idol. God says, you're not to have those. And then in verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. 1 Corinthians 10:14. Now, like I said before, well, we really don't have to worry about any of that. We don't have that in the church today, and don't have to worry, and nobody's getting thrown out of the church because they found images in his dresser drawer. Got suspended for church for doing that. But isn't it true that we're always to apply the spirit of the law, the spirit of the Ten Commandments? How about Colossians 3, verse 5? Colossians 3 and verse 5. Again, the English Standard Version. It says in Colossians 3, 5, put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, what's of the earth, what's carnal. Some of those would be sexual immorality, impurity, wrong kind of passions, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Oh, coveting is a spirit of idolatry. In other words, when you have something that you're coveting that is unlawful for you, then it's like an idol. Covetousness is the spirit of idolatry. It breaks the second commandment. You're setting up an idol in your life, worshiping that idol or coveting that. Ephesians 5 and verse 5. Ephesians 5 and verse 5. So there's a spiritual dimension. So maybe the second commandment comes back alive again. You know, didn't Paul say that? For when I was outside the church, the law, in a sense, didn't mean a lot because I was doing everything. That's Romans chapter 7, first few verses there. He said, well, I was doing everything, about verse 7 or 8, I was doing everything. But then he was called and he said, then the law, in its spiritual sense, came alive and he said, I died. At one point I thought, well, great, I'm not doing any of these things until the spiritual depth of it hit him, and he said, it came alive, and I was dead. I was guilty. So there's the spiritual side, Ephesians 5:5, for this you know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor somebody that's covetous, a covetous man, who is an idolater, coveting, lusting after something, that's having an idol. It's idol worshiping. You're an idolater. That's the second commandment. And the first two, putting something before God. Would have any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. So when we covet something, we're making that item a god, an image. Now there was a study, and a certain Ed Young had written about this. And it says, for many religious people, the popular question, you've all heard it today, is, well, what would Jesus do? There's a good question. Why don't we all stop and say, well, what would Jesus do before you make your move and your decision? For many religious people, the popular question, what would Jesus do, is essentially the same as, what would I do? That's the message from an intriguing and controversial new study by Nicholas Epley from the University of Chicago. Epley found their opinions on God's attitudes on important social issues closely mirrored their own beliefs. Well, what would Christ do? Now, what would God do? Well, pretty much what I would do, actually. That's what he found everybody was convinced of. He said, if their own attitudes change, so do their perceptions of what God thinks. Well, I thought you said God thought this way before. Well, I don't see it that way anymore, so I guess God changed too. That's what the study showed. They even used the same parts of their brain when considering God's will and their own opinions. In other words, when people ask them, well, what would Jesus do? Well, probably do what I'm about to do, of course. That's the tendency. That's what we as humans would tend to do. He wrote, the central feature of a compass, however, is that it points north no matter what direction the person's facing. North is north, period. Doesn't matter which way you're facing. This research suggests that, unlike an actual compass, inferences about God's belief may instead point people further in whatever direction they are already facing. Well, which direction's north? Well, I pretty much think it's this way. Well, it must be. That's the way we think. We make God in our own image. God's in our image. Humans tend to make God in our own image. Well, what's God like? Well, probably pretty much like I am, of course. Now, if you're somebody, if you're an individual or personality, let's say you're straight talking, no nonsense, pretty blunt, you tell it like it is, and you are that kind of personality, well, you see all the examples in the Bible where God says, spare not and cry aloud, and he tells it like it is, and he's this way and that way. In other words, he's probably pretty much the way you are. Now, if you're somebody like Barnabas, who is the son of consolation and had a different temperament and personality, well, God is long-suffering and gentle and kind, well, all the fruits of the Spirit. He's probably pretty much a little more like you are. We all make God in our image. That's what God's like. We all know there's dangers in doing this, don't we? What happened to the Jews? Was Jesus in the image of what they were going to look for as the Messiah? No. He didn't fit their image of what they were looking for as the Messiah. So they ended up rejecting the Son of God, their Savior, because he didn't fit their image. They weren't looking for the direction of the compass. They didn't say, well, look at all his teachings. Well, yeah, he really has insight. And, well, yeah, see, look at the way God's doing these things through him. Well, we should really consider. Well, they didn't think any of that. He wasn't in their image. And they rejected him. Another person writes, speaking of the mainstream Christian church, the church has given God a makeover to be a compromising, feel-good, user-friendly, bubblegum, reformed, unbalanced, and politically correct God to fit our own selfish needs. What's God really like? Well, he's into feelings, compromising, very user-friendly, and that's the way he is. That's the image we've made him. That's what we want him to be like. Several years ago, Oprah Winfrey was quoted on her highly rated television talk show as stating, "My God accepts gays." Well, her God does. Was it the real God? Now, I don't mean somebody trying to come out of that lifestyle and coming to church and repenting and all of that. I mean practicing that. She says her God accepts them in that lifestyle. Oh, really? That's her view. She's comfortable with that. That's what we do. That's what humans are about. We have that proclivity. It happens all the time. Sometimes parents want children in their image. Maybe a father's a certain way. Maybe he was a musician. Maybe he was a jock. Maybe he was this way. And sometimes parents have tried to force a child to be in the image they want them to be. But that's not them, not their temperament. Children sometimes want their parents to be like somebody else's parents. Why are my parents like these folks? and this one and that one. They want them in their image, what they want. We all do that. So what does Micah do? Micah sets up a shrine and an idol and his mom, and it's all for God, of course. This would be great. Why should we go to Shiloh? What a waste of money, time, and effort. It was a religion to suit them. The Levite, hey, this is great. I got a job, working out wonderful. It's just what we do, the way we are. Let's go to Luke chapter 14, a couple of concluding thoughts. We, of course, have to ask the question, what idols do we have? And how much do we make God in our image? Are we making a God in our image, or are we allowing the image that God reveals to us to make ourselves in His image? What do? How do we think? Or if we have idols in our own lives that we've set up? Well, here in Luke chapter 14, you recall the account many following Jesus in verse 25 of Luke 14, and they would have followed Jesus if he said, go back and get all your equipment, farm equipment and tools, and we're going to storm the Romans and get them out of our country and overthrow them and win back Israel for God and all of that. They'd all been behind it, and some of them died, and people have crusades all the time down through history. Well, he knew that wasn't the answer. So many thousands were following him, and he stopped and he said unto them, well, now wait a minute. If any man wants to come after me and doesn't love less his father, mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life, he can't be my disciple. You can't have anything before God. Can't set up any idols before God. God is first. That's the second commandment. First and second. So Jesus reiterated that. That's the distinction in our lives. We all struggle with our humanity, certainly. But at baptism, when we came to this, we said, no, there's nothing more important. There's nothing we value more than the pearl of great price, the truth, the relationship with God, our calling, the gift of the Holy Spirit. Anything that came before, that's an idol. It's idolatry. It's an image. Well, finally, Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6 is the same concept here. Verse 19. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth where moth and rust does corrupt, where thieves break through and steal. So our focus is the kingdom of God, something spiritual. Jesus, when he was about to die, said, well, unless something goes into the ground and dies, it doesn't live. Now, he, of course, was going to have to give up his life physically. We give it up in baptism. We die to this life. We're no longer in debt to this life. We've died. As Paul said, I'm crucified with Christ. So we've died, and unless you die in baptism, you won't live. You're not alive yet. So in verse 20, lay not up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust does corrupt, where thieves do not break through nor steal. Where your treasure is, there's where your heart is. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is focused and single and not straying from one side to the other, then the whole body will be full of light. But if your eye be evil, the whole body shall be full of darkness. That was Micah, his mother, the Levite, drifting. They might as well departed altogether. If your eye be evil, the whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you be darkness, how great is that darkness? So why would anybody include the story that strange story of Micah and his mother and the 1,100 shekels of silver and him stealing it and giving it back, and then why would he bother with that story and all the different other things we could write? Well, maybe there is a lesson in there. Maybe there is something to learn. Maybe there is something important that's of a spiritual nature. The first time they're veering from the way of God because of their own thinking and because they lacked an appreciation and an understanding of the second commandment. So that's the story of Micah and Micah's idols.